Why is the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs always so chock full of upsets? Well, the Chirp Podcast with Darren Millard has a legitimate answer. Today, Mike Kelly will blend the eye test with the raw numbers and explain the difference between regular season NHL action and the playoff version. It's all coming up next on the Chirp.
Heads up! Oh, how'd that feel, old man?
Boys, I'm Mike today. Just let everyone know, don't say anything stupid.
That's a disgrace! That's a disgrace! What a joke!
You guys are sensitive over there.
Yep. We are up and running. The Stanley Cup playoffs have arrived. By the way, I love that montage of all those clips. I can't get enough of that. I always end up finding something new as I go through it. And yeah, I do listen to the podcast myself. Hope the flurry of overtime games to kick off this postseason hasn't been too hard on the old nervous system. Yeah, things are a little frayed to start. Well, today, to just give you a little bit of a break, we're going to take all the emotion out of things, out of our game, and just look at it from 30,000 feet. Mike Kelly is from the National Hockey League Network, otherwise known as the NHL Network in most circles, and he also works with the analytics firm SportsLogic. He will stop by to size up the North Division. Can Winnipeg, can Montreal really advance to the second round and get by the behemoths in the form of the Edmonton Oilers and the Toronto Maple Leafs? So what will it take? And by the way, that Winnipeg series is all kinds of drama, trying to get past failures and past stumbles. So we know the Edmonton Oilers the last few years haven't accomplished what many expected with Leon Draisaitl and Connor McDavid in their primes. And Winnipeg, I mean, this thing against the Oilers and battling against the teams and the league's best player, goes back a few decades to Gretzky and Messier and Ranford and Curry and go on and on and on. Paul Coffey, Grant Fuhr, Andy Moog, I'll stop there. But it goes back all the way to the 80s and the 90s. And can Winnipeg finally overcome that cloud that's been hanging over version 1.0 or 2.0? So both clubs have something that they can accomplish against the other in that first round series. We'll dive into the North Division. We will also get an opinion from Mike on a question that I've always wanted to ask somebody, but never found the right person to put it to. And Mike is perfect. If the game and sport of hockey was invented right now, today, as you listen to this, with all of our knowledge with analytics, would our sport look, would it act, would it feel, would it present itself differently? And when I'm talking rules, I'm talking positions, I'm everything, coaching, how we pick the teams, what would it look like? And Mike is the perfect person to answer this. And he's also coming at us with an incredible response. So stick around for that. It is Mike Kelly on The Chirp with Darren Millard in an episode that you will learn something. I guarantee it as we dive into the numbers and the Stanley Cup playoffs on The Chirp Podcast with Darren Millard. The age-old question, we will begin with that. And it's not chicken or the egg, unless you can answer that one. Can you answer that one?
No, not at all.
Okay. Then we'll go to question number two of the age-old questions. How different is the play in the Stanley Cup playoffs than the regular season? Is it actually noticeable?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you hear coaches, players talk about it all the time, right? I remember being in Edmonton last year at a post-game press conference, and I think it was Rick Tocchet, one of the coaches, said it's a completely different game. You know, I actually think it was Jared Bednar. It is very different. So, you know, in the line of work that I do in analytics, one of the things I've done over the last couple of years, because I get this question a lot from especially coaches, is how is it different and what wins? And, you know, a couple of things that, you know, everybody listening to this will probably recognize just from watching the games, teams dump pucks in more because they have to, because there's less available space to carry the puck, certainly in the neutral zone, but really in all three zones, because it's just tighter checking. There's more puck battles. So there's a few different things that we track that you definitely notice an uptick in the playoffs. And especially as the playoffs go from round to round, as you get into, the conference final and the final, and there's really no available ice out there. So it is interesting to see those differences from the regular season, but also to see that there's truth that some teams are built better for playoffs than they are regular season. But of course the yin and the yang is you got to get into the playoffs. So it's a delicate balance there.
Why do you think it changes statistically
Again, I just think it's tighter check. I don't think you can play an 82-game season or 56 even with the kind of intensity that these teams play with in the playoffs. You'd run out of gas, you know, after 20 games probably. So it's different because it has to be. And I think, you know, Tampa, Florida game one was unbelievable. Like, that's playoff hockey and there's not a lot of space out there. So being able to build a roster that can play a tougher style of hockey. And I don't mean go out and fight. I'm talking competitive skill. Like, I look at a guy like Braden Point as such an awesome example of that. He's not a big guy, right? By NHL standards, he's a small guy. He wins puck battles at a rate that is as high as almost any forward in the league. You can't push him out of the fight. Kirill Kaprizov in Minnesota is the same way. You can't push him out of the fight. Those are the type of players, that skill, but also that, you know, grit, whatever you want to call it, but competitive skill. The teams that go far tend to have a lot of those type of players.
So would a exceptionally skilled team have more success against another skilled team as opposed to a team that grinds based on the numbers?
I believe so. And that's just kind of archetypes from teams, right? Like, if there's, you hear it all the time. Well, this is not maybe a good matchup for this team, even though this team might be a 1 seed and the other's an 8 seed or 2-7, whatever it might be. If you have two similar teams that play a similar way and one happens to be a little more talented than the other, then great. You get, you know, I'll use Tampa Bay and Columbus as an example of a bad matchup a couple years ago when Tampa rattled off whatever it was, 60 plus wins and got swept in the first round. What people may not appreciate about that Columbus team, they led the NHL in goals scored off the rush that year. They counterpunched as well as anybody. And so Tampa Bay was a high-skilled team. They carry the puck a lot. They like to carry the puck and make plays. Well, Columbus would cause these turnovers, and boom, they're gone, and they can make you pay. And they did that. I think Tampa learned some very valuable lessons, not only about roster construction, which they applied, but also getting guys like Kucherov and Stamkos and elite players to understand that if I don't have a play, I can't try to make one if it's not there. I got to get it deep. Pucks deep, right? That whole cliche. And find a different way, a more responsible way. And yeah, so they not only changed some of the players on their team, up and down the lineup, they played a different way. And obviously they were very successful doing it.
Sounds exactly like what Toronto is trying to do, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. I don't know about you. I've called Toronto Tampa Bay Light in the past just because they, you know, same type of team, a lot of high-end skill, love to play a skill game. But, you know, Toronto forechecks well. They play a heavy game pretty well. They win a lot of puck battles, those kind of things. But that's something I'm going to be watching in this series because if you – look, Toronto's the better team and they should win, and I think they will. But if you want to give Canadians fans some hope, Montreal counterpunches really well, kind of like that Columbus team did. Like – the Canadians score a really disproportionate amount of their goals off the rush compared to other teams. It's like, I'm kind of joking, but I'm kind of not when I say the best defense against Montreal is just to let them have the puck in your end once you're set up, because they can't get around a set up defensive team. They just go low to high and they shoot and it's shot volume and they don't score a lot by cycling the puck. So that would be the hope, I think, for the Canadians, is try to replicate that Columbus model where you're playing against a team that's better than you. But you kind of hold on, and then get one.
Mike, if Toronto and Montreal are separated by this much, just looking at the eye test standings, first against fourth, how much closer are they through analytics then?
I'll start at the very end and pull it back at the very end. I think our win probability has the Maple Leafs about 62.5% favorites. So it's not a landslide. But again, these are teams that play in very different ways. Like, I'll tell you, and I will guarantee this for the first round, Toronto will have the puck in Montreal's end more. They will have more offensive zone puck possession. They will have way more cycle chances. All this at even strength. Montreal could match them off the rush because they counterpunch really well. Like I said, but they're not going to win the territorial battle. So it's just, how well can you defend? How well can you hold on when Toronto's, you know, rotating all those guys around the ozone, doing their thing with all their talent? And how effectively can you counterpunch? But look, I was super high in the Canadians at the start of the year. I thought they could, a few things went right for them. They could win the division and they got off to this awesome hot start. Well, guess what they did? They scored almost 2 goals a game off the rush. They were just blitzing teams. But then teams said, hey, What if we take that away from them? Then what are they? There's not a lot there anymore. So that'll be how I think that series kind of goes in terms of how it's played.
So is it imperative on Toronto to change its game more in the playoffs than Montreal?
I don't think they have to, because again, I think they'll recognize that they're not going to want to try to make those same mistakes that Tampa Bay made against Columbus. Like there's a template there, and you touched on it earlier. I think it was a good point that they kind of seem to be following the Tampa Bay template of, well, we didn't get past, Columbus again in the first round. So what do we do? Well, what did Tampa Bay do? They went out and got some guys that can check and be gritty and provide leadership. And Toronto went out and did that too. And that's not what this team was about in the beginning with, their management team. It was about a lot of skill players and a lot of puck possession. You wouldn't think a couple of years ago they'd be looking for guys like Wayne Simmonds or Zach Bogosian, yeah, right? Given how they talked about how they wanted to play. But those are the kind of realities, I think, that you learn of what is required in the playoffs, that depth, different types of players being able to win in different types of ways. But Toronto's a top five team creating scoring chances by forechecking as well. So it's not just a light, star-based possession team. They've got different elements. So I don't think they'll have to do a 180 to play Montreal. But one thing I'll be watching is, are they going to kind of overdo those skill plays into the zone? And that's where you can get into trouble by, a defensive play, and then boom, you got an odd man rush and you're in danger.
Wouldn't it be interesting if Toronto ends up winning the Stanley Cup this year after the disappointment against Columbus and following what Tampa did after the falter against Columbus? People will be clamoring to face the Columbus Blue Jackets next year. Now the down part is Columbus didn't make the playoffs this year, so we won't have that to follow up on. Winnipeg and Edmonton is intriguing because I think Winnipeg's a higher skilled team than Montreal, but you're still going up against the juggernaut of the Edmonton Oilers. Does Edmonton have to tweak its game against the Jets from what you've seen?
I don't really think so. I mean, Edmonton had a lot of success against them in the regular season. I think they won 7 out of 9, right? And the Jets, you look at the last month, Darren, they're the worst record in the NHL.
Yeah.
Not the way you want to go into the playoffs, obviously, but there's one team in the league that finished bottom 10 in expected goals against, which is a reflection of team defense when you, as best we can, isolate goaltending away from it.
What does that mean, expected goals against? Just for people that aren't aware of the terminology.
So if you're a hockey fan, you probably heard of grade A scoring chances, right? Yeah. Coaches, players talk about it. It's the same thing. We're just putting historical data behind it to give ourselves an actual number. So instead of, an eye test, that looked like a grade A chance, we can say, well, based on where that puck was shot and the handedness of the shooter and the pre-shot movement and all these other nerdy terms that most people don't care about, you get a goal probability based on all the shots like it that came before. So you add those up throughout the course of a game. This shot, hey, that was a 20% expected goal probability because it was a good chance. Mm-hmm. Add them up throughout the game and you get one team and another team. And that's what should go in based on historical data. Obviously, you can have goaltenders that will come in and throw that right out the window because the Jets may give up a whole bunch of chances and a high expected goals against. And Connor Hellebuck plays lights out and gives up one goal and they win, which happens a lot in Winnipeg.
Yes.
So, expected goals against. So again, it's just the best reflection we have of just team defense without putting goalies in yet. Winnipeg was bottom 10. They're the only team in the playoffs that was bottom 10. Not good.
Wow.
Edmonton, they have Connor McDavid. He's very good at hockey. Leon Draisaitl, very good. These guys crushed everybody. And they're a very good offensive team. An unbelievable power play too, as you know. So, that alone is going to be problematic, but you made a good point too, I think, in that there's a lot of forward depth skill for Winnipeg. Nick Ehlers is so good. I don't know if people know this that don't watch him a lot. He could be a game breaker in a series for the Winnipeg Jets. Third line, when healthy, up there with the better third lines in the league. So they'll be looking for those depth contributions, I think. And if they can just saw off one of those, I think Draisaitl and McDavid will probably be split. That's how Dave Tippett did it in the regular season against Winnipeg. If a Winnipeg line can just saw one of those lines off, and then you can try to let your depth take over, you can be in the series for sure. And we know what Hellebuck can do, right?
Right. Ehlers and health, I mean, that's the big question mark, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, hasn't played in a little bit. And again, like when he's at his best, he skates the puck through the neutral zone as well as any player almost in the league, McDavid. But he'd be top five on my list anyways. So yeah, he can be a game breaker.
The idea of historical data also goes into it. And I don't know whether you can categorize this, but having lived through the Oilers and the Jets in the Smythe division, I already like going against the game's best player. That's the part that I can't get through. So you've got your data. We've got the game and the history from this year. And then I've got my own little, like what's singed into my heart. And I have trouble believing that Winnipeg will ever beat the Edmonton Oilers with the game's best player through the course of time.
Well, it's gone back so far. Like, how many times was Winnipeg one of the better teams in the league, right? And then you get stuck with these behemoths that you're just in the same division with.
Yeah.
Man, Calgary had some good teams back then, Edmonton, obviously. But, yeah, that's tough sledding. I'll say this, though, if you're a Jets fan, our model, for what it's worth, 51.4% in favor of Edmonton. That's pretty close. It's closer than I thought it would be. Again, Hellebuck could steal something. He could steal a game or two. He'll have to. Mike Smith has been, you know, talk about historical data. Goalies his age, he came into this season 38 years old in his age 38 season. One goalie in NHL history has a better save percentage than Mike Smith put up in their age 38 season. That was Luongo, I think, in 2017. Then it's Smith. Then it's the Gumper. Gump Worsley. You got to go way back. So he's having a great year, but, you know, what if? You know, the clock strikes midnight. I don't think it will, but there are some what ifs. But yeah, I'm with you. I mean, how do you, McDavid, 22 points in 9 games against Winnipeg? 22.
Do you like you're starting with a 2-0 lead right away? What in your data makes it closer than we expected?
Well, it's a good question. I have to go in and look at all the research I had done on it. You know, Hellebuck's a big part of it, obviously. Yeah. Like if you took the goaltending out, you would have a good forward group in Winnipeg, a really poor defensive team overall against Edmonton with the power play and the offense and all that. But I imagine Hellebuck would make up a couple points there. But I'd have to go back and look at all the details of it.
What's your favorite analytical equation? We've got heat maps. We've got charts. Where's your go-to if you need a quick reference on something?
Well, I kind of like to, you know, maybe you're like this as well, kind of in life with anything. Like I like to try to start at the finish line if I can, and then peel everything back to try to understand it the best that I can. So I'll look at expected goals for and against in a game, for instance, and say, okay, well, it looks like this team outplayed that team. Well, how did they acquire the expected goals in this game? Well, you know, certain chance types, whether it's rush, cycle, you know, odd man rushes, shot totals. It could just be way disproportionate in shot volume, but shot quality as well. How many came from the slot? How many came from the inner slot? The net front area where half the goals in the league are scored. Peel it back to try to understand what makes up those expected goals. And then you watch video and you just continue that repetition of how can I understand this better? And then that better that's underneath it. But that's where I start. And if you're a fan watching at home, just, you know, grade A chances, count them if you want in your head or on a piece of paper, like, oh, there's a grade A chance for that team, and see who has more at the end of the game. But I'll give you an example. I think, you know, Vegas Golden Knights have run into this a little bit last year in the playoffs. And even in game one against Minnesota, they outshot Minnesota. I think it was 42-30. Mm-hmm. Minnesota outshot them from the slot. And from that inner slot area, Minnesota outshot Vegas 8-4. Pretty big difference. So you go from the offensive zone possession, which was double for Vegas, to shots, which were more, to slot shots, which were less, to inner slot, the most dangerous, which were double for Minnesota. And Vegas talked about this when they got bounced in the playoffs last year. They lost the net battle. Got to make life harder on the goalie. You know, someone who's played goal before, I'm sure you could attest, and I've talked to other goalies about this too, even if you're getting a lot of tough saves, like a lateral one-timer, those are hard on a goalie. But if you kind of know they're coming and where they're coming from, you can at least adjust a little bit for it. It's different when you got a guy on top of you all the time. And I think Vegas will probably be looking to do that a little bit more.
8-4 in slot chances. And I looked at it like, how many saves did I remember Cam Talbot making that made me go, wow. And how many did Marc-Andre Fleury with that glove save? And you went, Well, it was heavily tilted towards Marc-Andre Fleury. So the eye test and the numbers certainly mesh in that regard. Can you tell me now that we're on Vegas and Minnesota, why a team might have another team's number? We deal with this in Las Vegas right now. And for the franchise's history, Minnesota has controlled the Golden Knights. It doesn't make any sense because there's been different incarnations and they didn't have Kirill Kaprizov and Cam Talbot and Dean Evason and so forth at the beginning. So what statistically, from an analytics standpoint, can you tell me why that is, or is there an answer to that?
It's a great question. It probably varies from matchup to matchup, year to year. I certainly can't speak in depth about past years without going through and looking closer at it. But, you know, this year, like the first game, like I talked about how that, you know, difference in zone time right down to, you know, the things that really end up mattering the most in the end went from Vegas to Minnesota. And the expected goals in the game were almost identical, despite more zone time and shots for Vegas. Regular season, this is one of the things that I looked at that kind of jumped off the page to me in the series was Minnesota third in the league, creating rebound chances around the net, and Vegas was 28th allowing them. So, you know, Vegas was an incredible defensive team. I think they were the best goals against in the NHL, but how do you break a team down and where are their little, you know, inefficiencies you could try to exploit within any team? That's what coaches are obviously looking at all the time. Can you get in front of Vegas's net and, you know, do their D struggle to box out, or is it just easier to pop in and out at certain times based on how they play? All things that coaches would be looking at. And then, you know, is Minnesota a team that can play a really good in front of the net type game? Yeah, absolutely they are. So is that going to be something, a trend to watch for as the series goes on? You can see it in the first game. You know, Vegas will obviously look to adjust some things, but I think more than anything, when you see, you know, a team that might just have another team's number, it could be goaltending first and foremost. Obviously, that's a huge thing that you know, numbers can't explain away a lot of the time, just because it's a freakish thing. But then it's matchup inefficiencies. Is one team just really good in one area that another team struggles in, even though the overall might be closer or even tilted a certain way?
Who is the analytical darling, the underdog? The team that maybe doesn't have home ice advantage, but you look at the numbers and say they could do something.
So Minnesota is one of those teams going in for sure. Just in terms of low seeds with the best win probability in the first round in our model, it was Tampa Bay. And it's, you know, you're kind of cheating there because they're the defending champs and whatever. You don't call them an underdog. But Boston was next and Winnipeg was third. So those would be the ones, I guess, to look for. The team I'd be kind of afraid of right now is Nashville. And I love Carolina. I think they're a team built for the playoffs. They're a heavy dump and chase, forecheck, in-your-face type team. But this Nashville team, over the last 25 games of the season, has a better record than Carolina. They are buzzing right now going into the playoffs, and they're hungry on pucks, and Saros has been amazing. So, you know, they're a team that, overall, during the season, you put it all together, not great numbers analytically, but coming in hot for sure, however much value you want to put on that.
I have wanted to ask this next question for a long time. It has nothing to do with the 2021 Stanley Cup playoffs, and I have to be careful how I phrase it to make it as less confusing as possible. How different do you think our game would be if analytics was at the forefront instead of the eye test? So if we came at this the building our game, creating our game, growing up with our game from an analytics base, and the eye test was the outlier, was the new kid on the block, do you think our game would be much different? And first of all, do you understand the question? Because I've gone through it in my head 1,000 times trying to figure out how to phrase it.
I think so. I mean, it is hard to imagine if we're talking like from day one back in like the early 1900s, how would this be different? Man, I'll say this, analytics in this sport are in its infancy, infancy.
Still.
In terms of where it will go and what it will ultimately, I think where it will settle in the game compared to other sports, it's new. It doesn't mean there's not a ton of value already in having the best information and being able to apply it as well as anybody, any other team, any other, whatever it is. But how would it be different? Well, I think we've understood through, you know, analytics, there are some truths. We understand the value of shot quality, but again, you could talk to coaches, some coaches 40 years ago that would have told you that, yeah, I don't want my team just throwing pucks at the net. I want, you know, the best quality shots possible. But how do you marry that with, well, offensive zone puck possession time? Like, I look at that as a defensive statistic, because I can tell you about teams that have the puck in the ozone a lot and don't do a lot with it. What can't happen when you have the puck in the ozone is the other team can't score on you ever. So there are teams that don't have a lot of offensive zone puck possession that score a lot because they attack off the rush really well and they don't need a lot of time in the ozone. So there are things intuitively that I think, like, if you see on a broadcast puck possession shows up on the score bug and it's 25 minutes for one team and it's 15 for the other, you're probably going to say, wow, I bet you the 25, you know, possession team is probably winning or should be winning. Not the case. Doesn't have a great correlation to winning hockey games, puck possession, not even offensive zone puck possession. Shots on goal don't have a great correlation to winning a hockey game, nor do shot attempts if you don't adjust for score effects and things like that. So there's a lot of understanding, I think, that goes into how to apply these things. What is most meaningful? To be perfectly honest, one of the greatest lessons I've learned in working in analytics full time for 5+ years now is what blind spots exist and how to best account for them by going outside of just numbers. That to me is massively important, because if all you do is eye test something, you're going to miss. And if all you do is analytics or numbers something, you're going to miss. So how can you put these things together and give yourself the most holistic view? And without being too long-winded, to get back to your original question, how would the game be different? I think you probably wouldn't have the structure, some of the structure that exists in terms of three forwards, two defensemen, a left winger, a right winger. It might be more fluid, and you see the game being more fluid the way it's played now. Power plays would be different. 1-3-1. Why do so many teams do that? Why aren't more teams attacking from behind the net or one side of the ice if that's where their strength is? There's a lot of things that could be different. It's a fascinating question for sure. But yeah, I think there'd be less structure in the game. I don't think it would be as over, you know, coached, I guess, maybe as it is now. Like, one thing I want to see is if you're trailing, say there's 5 minutes left and you're down a goal, you know, you're going to pull the goalie with maybe a minute and a half left, 2 minutes left. In those 3 minutes, why aren't you playing with four forwards and one D?
Exactly. Thank you.
Are we talking now?
Yes. Thank you.
And if that's how you're best, you know, built to win, maybe you've got two great offensive defensemen. That's great. But let's pick a team out of a hat, you know, Colorado.
Yeah.
Why aren't you, you know, and again, you're going to rotate some forwards too. You can't just have your big dogs on all the time, but you got Sam Girard out there. You got Kale McCarr out there. One of those guys at a time, and let your amazing forward just roll, you know, with them. And you've got some defensive, you know, acumen out there, but you're pushing for offense. You need to score.
Maybe a bad team more so than the really good teams.
Great point.
Should go with four forwards. Man, I knew we were going to be buddies. I absolutely knew it. And so I've got a game tomorrow, then I've got a game the next day. And what should I be talking about after the first period? If you've taken shots on goal, all my go-tos are gone. Possession, shot attempts, shots on goal, and hits. Where should I be going?
So one of the things that we do that I'm responsible for at my company is we work with all of our broadcast partners on how to bring analytics into their broadcasts in a simple way, in a way where you don't lose fans. We're not trying to make it an analytics broadcast. I say it all the time to our partners. The best use of analytics in a broadcast is when the audience doesn't know they're getting it.
Totally. Yes.
When you can tell a data-driven story that may not even have a number in it, but that's where it came from. You're just telling better stories. And that's what broadcasting the game is to me. It's storytelling. You're telling the story of the game as it happens. To answer your question, it is one of the things that bugs me the most is the scoreboard, because it's basically the same everywhere. It's goals, shots, hits, face-offs, maybe shot attempts. most of those things have a negative correlation to winning. Again, if you're not adjusting for score effects. So what would I use on my perfect score bug? Goals. I think shots, there's value there because fans understand it and they are meaningful to a degree. But then I would have quality shots on net, and you can make that fan friendly. If you don't want to get into a model, just do slot shots or inner slot shots. Chance types. One of the things we provide our broadcast partners is rush chances and cycle chances. Well, how are these teams generating their chances? If you're two periods in, and you know, offensive zone puck possession can tell a nice story too. But you've got a team that's up 3-2, despite not having as many shots, but their rush chances are like 9-2. That's a great story. But yeah, we're missing it. And again, you might see it and you'll know it because you're trained and you guys do an awesome job in your broadcast. You'll know that, hey, these guys are killing them with their speed, but you can put a number on it.
You know, it's hard though, if in our broadcast, our team is out shooting the other team 35-25, to sell that they're not outplaying them, or it's the reverse. And you're trying to sell people, hey, don't worry, we got them right where we want them. Like it's okay. That's a tough spin to do that in our very basic knowledge or basic approach to the game.
Because teams that outshoot their opponent lose more than they win. That's the math.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Across the board. That's the number. I didn't know that. Yep. That was across the board. I love the stats where a goaltender is like 5-1 when he faces 40 shots. Like that does seem to be a norm, but I didn't know that the team that gets outshot wins more.
So what ends up happening, and again, you know, the score of a game is a big part of this, right? If your team is up 3-0 going into the third, you may give up a lot more perimeter shots and you're worried about just protecting the critical areas. It's like baseball, you play, you know, no doubles defense, right? Mm-hmm. So shots on goal, look, they're not nothing. They are a big story in a game, obviously. But I before I look at shots on goal in a game, I look at the quality of those shots. I look at expected goals. I look at the quality of the shots. Then I get to shots. This is just kind of follows the path of correlation to winning in terms of what's most relevant. So it's a part of it. I wouldn't even advocate for eliminating showing it or talking about it, but it's one piece of a puzzle where, hey, we're out shooting them 35-25. And again, save for a brilliant goaltending performance. But the Minnesota example is great. You know, what if the graphic had said, hey, we outshot them 42-30, but look at the shots from the slot. Look at the shots from the inner slot. Look where the game winning goal was scored. Now you're telling with numbers a bit of a different story.
So you really do yell at the TV?
I try not to. I've gotten better.
Yeah.
I have an appreciation for what's been done and why it's been done. I get it. And I'm not somebody just because I work in this space who thinks that the whole broadcast should be analytics. I do think there's improvements that can be made, but I think watch a baseball game and you've got X players with no background in statistics or analytics, and they use numbers all the time. They're talking about launch angles and they're talking about spin rates, and it's just become accepted. In basketball, you see it. You'll see it in hockey. It will go there. It's what is going to be used, how much of it is noise versus the signal, and who's going to get there first.
It's easy to be lazy, right? And just go off your eye test and do that. So that must make you just completely bananas when somebody's going down that path.
It only does if I know there's a better way. Right. You know, it's funny because some of the analysts that we work with, and we work with some of the best analysts in the game, at the national level, that are already the best because they see the game so well. And they're the ones typically that come to us and say, you know, hey, how can I use this stuff in my broadcast and how can I get better? And it's kind of funny. Like, it made me think, these are the people that probably need it the least, but they're the ones that are the ones that want to adopt it. Maybe that's why they're the best already at what they do, right? Because they're always looking to be as good as they can be. And that's beyond this. That's sports in general. It's life, I think, in general. I don't, a lot of the people that do these games, they know the game so well, they see 90%+ of it for what it is. If we can help, you know, fill in as much of that 10% as possible, we're just getting a little bit better, which I think is what analytics is. It's how can I get incrementally better and give myself a competitive advantage.
I'm going to sound so smart next time I'm on the air. So just absolutely brilliant. Who are some of your analytical darlings, from an individual standpoint?
Well, the guy a year ago that I was big on, NHL Network asked me to pick a player at the start of the year to, you know, who's the guy to watch this year? And I said Carter Verhaeghe. And I think they looked at me like I had two heads in the beginning, because they're like, really, you want to talk about this guy? Like, we've got all these superstars in the game. You're selling this.
Yeah.
But there was a reason for it. Now, I didn't think he'd go to where he's gone to, but I knew he could be a very productive top six player. Analytics. Great scouts would see it with their eyes, I'm sure, as well. But there were a number, like, you have to level things at a per, whatever, 20, 60 minute rate with a player like that because of the usage. They only played minimal minutes on fourth line type of role. But the scoring chances he had and that he created for his teammates. Number one in puck recoveries, loose puck recoveries per 20 minutes in the NHL. Great forechecker. All these things that were just under the surface. You're like, man, some guys can't handle the big minutes in the bigger competition and continue with those numbers. Some guys can. And the more I dug on this guy, I'm like, I think he's a guy that could do it. And he's
done
it.
Hold on. Before you go any further, what made you think that he could transition from a guy who can do it with fewer minutes and a lesser role to being at a higher position?
In limited times that he's been in those spots, he's been fine. And going back to, like, he led the American League in scoring a couple of years before with Syracuse. I mean, there is a sample of him in pro hockey being a big guy and getting it done. So that exists. I've fallen into this pitfall before a couple of years ago with a player who had a lot of these same type of numbers that I thought, you know, he got moved at a deadline and I thought, you know, wow, that could be someone who could be a good player for this team, and it didn't work out. And it hasn't. So there's trial and error that exists for sure. Again, always just trying to be better than you were the day before in anything that we do. But Verhaeghe was a guy, I thought he could go and play top six and be a good player for them. I did not think he would be one of the better even strength goal scorers in the NHL this season. That's been a boon for Florida.
So do you remind everybody at the network about that?
Hey, nobody else going to pump your tires, right? You got to do it yourself.
Exactly.
That's it. Pump everyone until will they tell explode. Me when I'm wrong. Yeah. Everyone will tell me every time I'm wrong. So I don't need to remind myself of that, but I sprinkle it in every now and then. I can, you know, we're talking, doing a highlight. Hey, there's Verhaeghe. Remember that Carter Verhaeghe guy? But look, Vegas found a ton of those guys. I mean, yeah. I think they apply analytics as well as any team in the league. They do a great job.
Yeah, Chandler Stephenson, Matthias Janmark, they've moved in. Nick Waugh, three acquisitions where they've backfilled, and Chandler's now playing top line minutes. Before I let you go, Jeff Carter, how did you see that acquisition and at the start, and then what you're seeing now? I didn't like the acquisition. Mainly because he's got a year left. That's what I didn't like about it. But I admit that even with the one game that slightly skews the stats with the goals, he's been good.
No question. I didn't see this coming either. I think when you look at how Pittsburgh plays, and again, they're a team, a lot of skill, like they can beat you in different ways, but Vegas scored the most goals in the league off the rush. Pittsburgh was second, tied with Florida. They play fast. Jeff Carter can move. You know, he's getting up there in age, but he's not slow. And you put him in a bit of a depth role with some good players. You can, after the fact, you can kind of look at it and say, oh, okay, I can see how that can make sense. You kind of fit into, you know, what they want to do pretty well. I didn't see it either. I thought he'd be fine. I didn't think he'd be, you know, it's another good body to have going into the playoffs, a guy who would be a regular and be fine. Maybe, you know, there's things that I missed that they saw. I'm not sure. He's been phenomenal for them. So you know, Pittsburgh's got a good track record too, right? Of finding those pieces that they need to make something happen.
Well, one of the best at trying to surround those pillars. Who is your pick? Did you give a pick for the Stanley Cup?
I don't know that I did. So do it here, I guess.
Yes,
look, in my line of work, you hate doing it, right? Because the playoffs are a bit of a crapshoot to begin with, and I deal in probabilities, and nobody.
And you're judged more. You're judged more harsh than me, because I can throw a team out there and be like, he just doesn't know what he's talking about. But you've got an actual foundation to it.
Oh no, I wear that pressure, even though I probably shouldn't. But
you do.
Look, I want to be right as much as possible. Like, I don't know that I have the luxury of being wrong as often as some other people, to be perfectly honest, because I come from a different background. I didn't play in the league for 20 years. I can't just say, well, that's what I saw. And that's what I saw. You know, not to say that that's what everybody does or anything like that, but I do feel like I need to be a little bit more right than most to kind of anyway. So yeah, I deal, like I said, in probabilities. And the funny thing about making predictions, if you're like, yep, this team's a 65% favorite, that's a big favorite. Oh, they lost. Well, you didn't know, your model sucks. It's like, there was still 35. Nobody thinks of the 35, but look, I'll tell you, I like Colorado. I know they got a war zone to get out of to make it happen. Like St. Louis is no joke.
No.
They play a physical possession heavy brand of hockey, and Colorado can do it too. But if Grubauer stays healthy, it's a big if, as long as that happens. And I know they'd have to go through either Vegas or Minnesota, and that's hard. But if you can get through those two rounds, that's no joke either. So I just think they're so well-balanced offensively. They were one of the best defensive teams, too, in terms of expected goals against. I think they were number one. So they don't have a lot of missing pieces that I can poke holes in.
Do you have a lot of these conversations with yourself?
Yes, I do. I overanalyze, trust me, believe me. But I love it. I mean, it's the best job, and I get to talk to a lot of great people in the game, people that cover the game, do a lot of research. I'll tell you one thing. I love kind of getting the other side of it, the eye test side of it, because I know there's so much value there, and there's value in this side too. And, you know, some of the best conversations I have with people are with full eye test people that eventually will say to me, yeah, you know what? I never really was that big into numbers, but this kind of stuff, it makes sense. Like, I get it. And then you're like, okay, now we're talking the same language, and now we can go and get to somewhere good.
Feel good when a coach phones you up, wants to pick your brain a little bit. Is that still kind of cool?
Yeah, it is. You know, you read the name on the phone, and I'm just like, oh God, here we go. Okay. You know, try to everything.
Do you think you're in trouble?
No, not at all. But like, I'm trying to think of like, okay, what's everything that I know about this team and this coach and this player off the top of my head and go. Cause the thing about coaches is it's like, it's not, hey, you know, how's your wife? How's your kid? There's a bit of that, but it's pretty quick into what's this, what's that, what are we doing? And away you go. Right. They're pretty to the point, but, I did a presentation for a group of coaches, a lot of NHL coaches, some American League ones as well last summer. And I talked about the danger of, and again, I'm taking now my interpretation of the analytics. And that's what analytics is in a lot of ways, is somebody's interpretation of it beyond just the black and white. My interpretation was, I understand you want to have the puck in the offensive zone. Everybody does. Nobody will ever say that's bad. So full stop there. But I do think there's a danger in overvaluing what that is, because you will hear sometimes teams say, oh, we had the puck in the ozone a lot. I like the way we played. We didn't win. I really see it as a means to an end, not an end point. And so the whole discussion was, you know, why I believe that and why I believe that it is something to be valued, no question. But winning that battle in a game doesn't really mean you won anything if you're not winning certain other critical areas. And they had their own thoughts on it, all valid for sure. And we had a great back and forth. I think I hopefully left them with some new information to consider. They gave me some things to consider about the realities of the game and the fluidity of it and the way that it's played. I learn, they learn, you continue. It's, you know, I love the TV stuff. I love so many parts of my job, but it's the problem solving that's never ending. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning for sure.
Little dialogue, right? Brainstorming almost. Yep. Sounds like what you guys went through.
Yep.
If you don't want the puck in the offensive zone all the time, what do you want to do with it? That there's my little big dilemma.
So again, if you can have it in there all the time, it's great. The problem is that you can't. So you can't build a team just with that in mind, because the top team in the league at having the puck in general or having it in the offensive zone to the bottom team in the league is not great enough to say that that's the thing that we're just going to do. Okay. You can't have it that much for it to mean that much, because it's just not practical. Maybe if you were a super team in a 16 league, you could do it. 31 teams, salary cap, can't be done. So of course you want to do it, and of course you want to have it. And the teams that have it the most in the offensive zone, it's still about 8 minutes out of a 60 minute game that you've got the puck on your stick in the ozone. It's not a lot. There's a lot of other things that go on in a hockey game that you need to be aware of. So, you know, again, you could just look at teams that create a lot of chances off the rush and can score in different ways versus teams that will cycle it a lot. The Islanders will give you the outside. They say as much. Have it on the perimeter. They, year after year, rank towards the bottom of the league in defending in their own end and are always one of the best teams in goals against average and expected goals against because they don't give up the middle. They protect the critical areas. And there's more dimensions to their game. So it's a piece. It's a piece, that's all. But that is the first thing you get back for sure is, well, what do we do if we don't have the puck in the ozone? We don't want that. Like, of course you do, but yeah, it's just things to consider. And, you know, Bill James talked about it when he worked with the Red Sox. Weaponize the decision makers. Here's the information. Here's what I believe. You go make the decision. You are the expert in coaching this team. And you know all the other intricacies and details of what goes on and how to apply it. But we're here to give you information to help you think about things maybe in a different way. And away you go.
Last one for you. Analytics were not used heavily pre-Vegas expansion. Much more involved in the Golden Knights and will be certainly with the Seattle Kraken. Is that the major reason why Vegas was successful and why we expect Seattle to be successful?
Part of the reason, no question. I think Vegas, from some of the moves that they've made, looking at players they've acquired, expansion draft since then, you could look at players that we would look at it from an analytic standpoint and say, oh yeah, that makes sense. That's good. That's good. And they've done well. You know, my company at Sport Logic, we work with a vast majority of the teams in the league. So there's a lot of teams that use, you know, really, really good data. So then it becomes, well, how do we continue to try to have that competitive advantage? How do we interpret the data? How do we combine that data with maybe things that we track on our own, other methods of evaluation? That's where the competitive advantage continues. Once you have the information, is building the systems. And some teams, you know, there's going to be a team that is number one, and there's going to be a team that's 31 and everything in between in terms of how that all works. So yeah, I think Vegas, if you look at the moves they've made and how they've operated, pretty clear that they've done very well in that area. And Seattle has taken a position where they've invested heavily in analytics, which is great. Obviously I think the more teams that do that, the better, and all teams should do more of it. But it's never the be all end all, like anything. Nope.
I won't admit this too often, but a lot of this podcast was for me, trying to get to the bottom of certain things, ask questions that I've always wanted to ask, and learn along the road. It's one of the great advantages of being on a podcast is being a little more selfish every now and then. You've been awesome at sorting through this. Really appreciate it. Would you mind joining us again in the near future?
Oh, happy to do it. And great talking to you. I obviously watch a lot of Vegas broadcasts. You guys do a great job and listen to the podcast as well. So happy to do it. And, you know, for me, I think we always talk in a general sense of how do we sell the game? How do we, you know, get fans as invested in the game? How do we attract new fans? You tell the stories of the players and you know, hey, player X, you know, works with this charity, or they did this trip, or they do this thing. And it's great. There's that whole engagement side. I think with data and information and statistics, you can engage fans in the same way, just in a different way of, hey, watch for this player to do this thing in this game because he does it better than anybody. And the message you'll get back is, oh, you know, I saw him do that. That was cool. You're just engaging fans in a different way.
Next time I make a big deal about the shot clock in a close game, text me and say, get your head out of your butt.
Hey, more often than not, if you have a lot of shots, you got a lot of quality ones too, but there are those outliers for sure. So I'll shoot you a heads up. And when the Vegas fans hear you talking about, did we look at the inner slot?
Yes.
I know that we were having a chat.
Thanks, buddy. Really appreciate it. You're awesome.
All right. Thank you.
You can catch Mike on the NHL Network, or as I refer to it as the National Hockey League Network. I will try not to abuse my access to his knowledge, but I cannot promise that I won't text him during the course of the next game, like middle of the first period or second period of the series against the Minnesota Wild as we're broadcasting it. I may just reach out to him. I just brought so much and made me think about so much regarding how we analyze the game and how we look at the game. Now, I'm more of a feel person. I'm not big on the heat maps. I admit that. Those kinds of presentations, I really need to be able to think it through, not just look at numbers. And I like the way Mike offers it up and how he presents his knowledge. What did you think? I'm curious. Did you learn something? Did you go, that's great, but it's not going to affect me day to day, or how I watch a game on a Tuesday night? Or maybe on the other end of the extreme, there's nothing about this that that really grabbed your attention. And you know, there's probably somewhere in the middle, but I'm curious. Let me know through Twitter at Darren Millard, one R in Darren, two L's in Millard. And my direct messages wide open. Send me a note there, or just post it on Twitter and tag me in it, and give me your thoughts on this episode of The Chirp with Darren Millard with special guest Mike Kelly. Also want you to hit that like button, hit that rating button, and let us know what you thought. That does go a long way. Right now, it's the end of the podcast. Just do it. Like, take 2 seconds out of your day. Bob Bender would be so appreciative, and it would help get Bob off my back. That's probably the best reason why you do it. Like, everybody's got that one person that rides them about something, and you're like, please just get off my back about this. Bob's that way with trying to get you, the listener, the viewer, to rate, subscribe, and review. So if you can do that, I would be eternally grateful. Thanks for listening to The Chirp with Darren Millard. Mike Kelly for stopping by, and of course, Bob Bender for making it all happen. And even though he's a bit of a hard guy to get along with at times. Thanks for listening. Appreciate it. Be good, everybody.